Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and I'm honored to have as my guest today retired Dr. Peter Cookson. And Peter is going to talk about the coronavirus because, you know, on the radio and TV, we hear about the number of cases and we really don't know the specifics of what it's all about, how it started, how it's spreading. So Peter is going to enlighten us. So Peter, how are you?
I'm just great. And the sun came out today and it stopped raining. So that helps a great deal.
It does. So from your understanding, what should people know about the coronavirus that they might not know now?
Well, the folks in the media, mainstream media, have done a good job in terms of giving an outline as to how to avoid spreading the disease from one individual to the next. And they have, you know, spelled it out. And it's not important for me to go through the steps that good people have determined are important steps to take in order to stay well. So what my interest is, how does the flu work and how does it devastate the human body and kill people? That was my interest as a family doctor. What did I need to focus my attention on? Which organ system, for instance, was most likely to fail under the weight of or the attack by the viral organism? And so what I have actually seen in years past during my training at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia was evidence of disease in the lungs that is caused not only by viruses and what they call the viral storm or the immune storm that occurs, but also I saw in the pediatric population what happened to the lungs of little children who were exposed to very high concentrations of oxygen, primarily in the pediatric nurseries. And the pathological features are much the same, and that is the exudation or transudation or collection of proteinaceous dense material in the tiny air sacs of the lungs that, in the case of the coronavirus, are a result of the immune system response to the organism, that is the virus, that has found its way into the cells that line the air sacs. And when that occurs, the air sacs fill with fluid and are no longer able to allow air or to permit oxygen to travel from the air sacs into the bloodstream. And so basically the patient is asphyxiated or dies, drowns in its own fluid. But what's also interesting is that the recent appearance of what has been described as in 1961 by Dr. Kawasaki, and later he wrote the important article in 67, about what has been characterized as Kawasaki disease or mucocutaneous lymph node syndrome, which is a big long word for, it affects the mucous membranes of the mouth, and it affects the lymph nodes. And it's a syndrome, which means it's a collection of signs and symptoms. And that's very interesting because it also shows that there are additional organs in the body that are susceptible to attack by the coronavirus, not only the lungs, but also, in the case of the children, heart muscle and heart and blood vessels. We're starting to see that in adults as well. which is really interesting in terms of how the adults are dying or what's killing the adults. Not only are they drowning in their own fluids if the organism stays in the lungs exclusively, but there was a recent report in the Schenectady Gazette about the requirements or the demand for kidney dialysis equipment, because they found that the kidneys of patients who are suffering from coronavirus are failing. That is, the virus has attacked the kidneys as well, which is really interesting, meaning that it's a very different organism from the organism that attacked humans back in 1918, 1919, which primarily restricted itself to the lungs. So also the patients who are recovering are talking about loss of taste and sense of smell, suggesting very strongly that the organism is attacking the brain as well. The loss of taste and smell does not a result of the attack of the nose and the tongue, but an attack in the central nervous system. There are others who are complaining of dizziness or lightheadedness or who are, you know, just having difficulty walking around because it feels like they're intoxicated, and that's telling you that the virus has gotten directly into the central nervous system. Which portion of the central nervous system is being attacked, I'm not sure, but we certainly know that in the survivors of the 1918-1919 flu epidemic in the United States, there was a huge number of people who developed Parkinson's disease in the late 60s and 70s, which is a remarkable interval between recovery, which would have been 1920, for instance, and 1960. You're talking 40 years, 50 mm-hmm. years later, all of a sudden these people who had contracted the great influenza during the epidemic of 18 and 19 are suddenly coming down with Parkinson's disease in the 60s and 70s of the last century. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a remarkable organism that we haven't seen before, although we've seen its friends and neighbors, and we call those SARS. I think that they are related. There's no question they're related, but where did it come from is another interesting story, and I agree with the experts who say this came from someplace other than a laboratory. I agree with that. It's way too complex, and there are too many other indicators that it came from someplace else. And there are people who have studied where do these epidemics come from, and good people have concluded that they come from outer space, believe it or not. And if you don't like that idea, why, that's okay. But there are good people who have studied this thoroughly and find that it does. And if you look at other epidemics in the ancient past, you find that the mode of transmission is not person to person, but is by some other mechanism, and the only thing that fits is the atmospheric transference of pandemics that occurred many hundreds and in some cases thousands of years ago.
But this virus, this epidemic, it spread from person to person, right?
Yes, at this stage, yes.
Now, one question I've got is, you know, and during our conversations, we talked about it mutating. So what might hit one person might not hit another person, and it mutates to another part of the body and other symptoms, right?
Yes. Yes,
okay.
It has that capacity, and it's already demonstrating that in terms of the organs that are involved. Now, does that represent a mutation? I don't know if that's fair to characterize it. Virologists characterize changes in virus organisms with the terms Shift and what's the other one? A minor alteration and a major alteration. A major alteration would be characterized as a mutation, and the other one, oh, drift. That's the other word I was looking for. A drift, which would be the term that they use to characterize a minor alteration of the virus, and a shift would be to how to characterize it as a major alteration. The expectation is that, or the history of viruses in the past, is that they are very much capable of drifting. In fact, they do that routinely. And does that mean that the virus that attacks initially the lungs can then modify its behavior very slightly that would enable it to attack the gastrointestinal tract? Yes,
mm-hmm.
for sure. We see lots mm-hmm. of patients complaining of diarrhea, vomiting. Is that the same organism that attacked their brother or their sister that attacked their brother or sister in terms of respiratory symptoms? Sure, probably. Mm-hmm. I think what you're asking is, can it mutate or shift to a far more deadly organism than what it already has today? And the answer to that question is yes, for sure. And how long does that take? Who knows? What's the history of the great flu epidemic of 1819? It seems like it took about 6-8 months or so between the time when it first manifested itself in Haskell County, Kansas, to the time when it exploded in the East Coast in the fall of 1918. So that's just a guess. That's basically what happened then. Will that happen, repeat performance this time? Who knows? But that's what certainly has happened in the past. And we should be prepared for such an eventuality this year, this fall, and perhaps even this summer, as soon as this summer. And if that happens, then we need to take the same vigorous, aggressive isolation methods that we have taken under the direction of our wonderful leader in the state of New York, who gets it, who understands how this thing works and how to protect the citizens of this state.
So, you know, it's all very interesting, but at the same time, it's scary. Now,
yes.
People are getting sick with this, you know, to degrees. Some people are very sick, some people are not very sick. So my question is, could something like this wipe out the entire human race?
Not likely. Is it possible? It's always possible, but the answer is, could it? Well, of course, you know, anything is possible, but would it? No, probably not.
Okay, so what would be the I don't know if the word is stopgap measures, or how would it end? So that the entire human race doesn't become extinct.
Right. Okay.
Does it just die itself out? Is the injection the way to go? The vaccine, is that the way to go? Explain, you know, how you think that this might not wipe out the humans.
Okay. All right, so several questions there. First, my first thing that I would deal with is that there are other pandemics that struck the human race in years past that lasted for years, that did not go away in the first 6 months, year, or even 2 years or so. Some of them lasted 4, 5, 6 years or so before the susceptible individuals in the human race were all either sickened and recovered, or dead. And okay. So it may go on for that length of time. There are other pandemics or epidemics that struck hard the human race. And in long, long ago and far, far away, there were people that lived in isolated communities that had little or no contact whatsoever with the rest of the people on the planet. And they basically were isolated. And they survived. They did okay, and they propagated and went on and perhaps filled in where the people on the planet that were susceptible to the epidemic, the Black Death, for instance, were all killed and left huge vacancies in places to live on the planet.
So what I'm asking is, does this virus or other viruses just die out? What happens to them?
Right. Okay. They can continue to either drift, that is, change their behavior as a result of genetic changes or modifications, or shift to a different level of behavior that is less aggressive, less fatal, less virulent, is a term that the medical community uses. That can happen. And when that happens, if it does indeed, and it probably will, then people will get symptoms that do not threaten their lives, but are on the level of a bad cold or a flu type of syndrome. And then they go about their way, and they can develop an immunity or for that will last for longer or shorter period of time, depending upon what the immune system decides to do about it. And I don't know why the immune system is able to establish permanent immunity to certain viruses and limited immunity to other viruses. I don't know what makes it decide that, but certainly we know that measles vaccination produces permanent immunity and other vaccines don't. So, and I think the other part of your question was, do I think that a vaccine will enable the human race to, quote, get over it, unquote, that is, no longer be susceptible to this particular virus. Did I understand your question correctly?
That's correct.
Okay. So you're asking about a vaccine. And my answer to that is that the organism has demonstrated already its ability to shift its genetic makeup or drift the genetic makeup. Once it's done that, or once it's shown its ability to do even more aggressive changes, then that means that you need to make another vaccine, much like the people who work each year so hard to identify and develop a vaccine that will enable us to survive or overcome or not to get infected by the routine influenza, by the influenza virus that comes around every year. So they work diligent and hard, and many times they are absolutely right, and the vaccine that they develop is very, very useful and eliminates a lot of the disease or enables people to develop only very minor symptoms. Other times, not so well, but it's generally a very useful tool. In the case of HIV, though, they have found that they just can't make it. They can't, which is a close relative to the coronavirus. They simply cannot come up with a vaccine that is useful to treat and to vaccinate the population of the planet to make them immune from HIV. So if that's indeed the case with that, will that be the case with this virus? I have no idea. Only time will tell, and there are good people around the world working on that particular question and trying to solve the answer to it.
Well, you know, with HIV, the government was kind of slow in reacting, and I believe it was during the Reagan administration because it was segregated into a certain portion of the population. And Reagan didn't really care about gay people, so therefore, you know, it kind of, you know, proliferated more than it should have, right?
That's a political question. Right, and that's outside the purview of the medical practitioners. And that was
okay.
that was an issue that has been... I'm certainly very familiar with what you're saying. There's no question about that at all. And I would not challenge your lead in to that particular question. It's just that good people in the medical community have struggled very hard for a very long time to develop a vaccine that would be effective in treating HIV. And they've been unable to do so. And there's lots of... You know, the theory is that the organism is able to change its genetic makeup quickly enough that will render whatever vaccination or vaccine they come up with useless. There are other people who have other ideas as to why they haven't worked quite as hard or come up with anything. And that's pure speculation and speculation, put it that way, and I won't get any further into that. But if indeed that's the case here with this coronavirus, that the good people cannot come up with a reliable vaccine, then we're going to have to, quote, tough it out, unquote, and continue doing what other health department epidemiologists have said. The best way to deal with a pandemic, epidemic like this, is isolation and hygiene. And they are absolutely right from that in every aspect of that, those recommendations.
So when this first, you know, started on the news, when you first started hearing it on the news, it was before February, I'm sure. Did you realize it was going to be this bad?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, it was in December when I became aware of the fact that there was trouble brewing. And I was aware of it in December because, as a routine, I make myself aware of news sources that most people don't, you know, have access to, but they just don't bother because it's a pain in the neck and it's hard to do. But in December of 2019, sorry, I heard the stories coming out of Wuhan, and I said, oh, my goodness, I know exactly what those guys are talking about. I have in my library the book that was written in 04 or 05 by a fellow by the name of John Barry about the flu epidemic. And I had read that book in 05, and it came back to me immediately. And I went to my library, got the book out, and started reading in December. And by golly, as I read, what I was tracking was the coronavirus through China. And China was doing exactly everything right from the outset. They must have read that book too, or there are other books as well. But they must have read that because they were following the recommendations of the good people in 1918 and 1919 who were doing their best using the tools that they had at their disposal to combat the flu. But they were also up against, those persons were up against a number of individuals who were in control of populations, the politicians, who did not understand what they were dealing with and ignored the recommendations of the medical community back in the 1918-1919 flu. And therefore, many, many people suffered and died needlessly. But yes, I was aware of what was going on back in December of 2019. It wasn't a mystery. There were no mysteries, and nobody was trying to keep it a secret. It was right there on the television in December. And so
right.
There was no mysteries. There was nothing. All you needed to do was to know what the heck, you know, to read the signs or listen to what these people were telling you, and to have had some knowledge of medical history. And because I had that knowledge, I put all of it together the first time I heard it. And I said, oh my, I know exactly what this is, and I know exactly what they're talking about. And I went to my library, and there it was.
Well, people are not as astute as you, because you were trained to be a doctor. So like in February and March, when this took hold, panic developed, and it became very frightening, and places were shut down, and chaos started, and it hasn't been really a terrific time. Would you agree?
I agree. You're very kind.
Yeah.
But in February of 2020, the pathway to management of the coronavirus had already been cleared by other medical communities and other nations, who said, this is how you deal with it. It's hard, but it's much better than dealing with dead people.
Okay.
So, you know, people, all they needed to do was their heads up and look and see, has this question been answered before? And the answer to that question is yes. And how did they answer it? And was the answer successful or unsuccessful? And the
mm-hmm.
answer was yes. There were good people who were confronted with similar situation, who dealt with it in a very successfully. And so the way we dealt with it was not quite the same.
Okay. So we have like about a minute left, Peter.
Yeah.
And the minute we have left is, do you have any final thoughts?
Yes, I do. My thought is that to prepare yourself for the fall, for the upcoming. The statistics so far have demonstrated that approximately 80% is the number I have seen of persons who have tested positive for coronavirus have no symptoms. And those individuals are out and about and doing good, productive work, raising their families and working hard. They have the virus somewhere in their system lurking. Will that virus then mutate, shift, and become more virulent sometime later? It is my contention that is a reasonable possibility. Viruses, bacteria, our microorganisms respond to declines or deficiencies in our immune system. Our immune system can be reduced in its effectiveness through starvation or other kinds of stress. If you're curious about that, read the history of tuberculosis during the Second World War in Western Europe, that is Holland, Belgium, France, Norway, Denmark, and Great Britain. When the population was under great stress from the war, the increase or the number of individuals who had quiet tuberculosis suddenly found themselves with active tuberculosis. And those who didn't have it at all contracted it from their friends and neighbors and other members of the family who had active cases, coughing, and so on. So I am very concerned that the coronavirus is lurking in the bodies of many of our friends and neighbors. And if we have difficulties in the economic sphere that stresses our friends and neighbors, they may then have clinically obvious signs and symptoms of what we're seeing now in the older folks.
Well, so Peter, thank you so much. And, you know, as this horrible story evolves, you know, I would like to have your, you know, your commentary from time to time. So you have been listening to retired Dr. Peter Cookson. This is All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler. If you like this show, follow us on Twitter. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And stay safe. Have a great day.
Oh, bye-bye, Cynthia.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.